That would be really dumb because,
Forces narrowed his eyes. Percy slipped his hand into his pocket. He closed his fingers around Riptide. Even this old sea god must be smart enough to realize they were the demigods with the bounty on their heads. But Forces just grinned and elbowed Frank again.
Ha! Good one, child of Mars.
I suppose you're right. No point talking about it. Even if the demigods found that map in Charleston, they'd never make it to Rome alive.
Yes, the map in Charleston,
Frank said loudly, giving Percy a wide-eyed look to make sure he hadn't missed the information. He couldn't have been more obvious if he had held up a large sign that read, Clue.
But enough boring educational stuff, Forces said.
You paid for the VIP treatment. Won't you please let me finish the tour? The 3 denarii entrance fee is non-refundable, you know.
Percy wasn't excited about more fireworks, donut-scented smoke, or depressing captive sea creatures. But he glanced at Frank and decided they'd better humor the crabby old god, at least until they found Coach Hedge and got safely to the exit. Besides, they might be able to get more information out of Forces. Afterward, Percy said, can we ask questions?
Of course! I'll tell you everything you need to know.
Forces clapped his hands twice. On the wall under the glowing red sign, a new tunnel appeared, leading into another tank.
Walk this way.
Forces scuttled sideways through the tunnel. Frank scratched his head.
Do we have to?
He turned sideways. It's just a figure of speech, man, Percy said. Come on. Chapter 16. Percy. The tunnel ran along the floor of a gymnasium-sized tank. Except for water and some cheap decorations, it seemed majestically empty. Percy guessed there were about 50,000 gallons of water over their heads. If the tunnel were to shatter for some reason... No big deal, Percy thought. I've been surrounded by water thousands of times. This is my home court. But his heart was pounding. He remembered sinking into the cold Alaskan bog, black mud covering his eyes, mouth, and nose. Forces stopped in the middle of the tunnel and spread his arms proudly.
Beautiful exhibit, isn't it?
Percy tried to distract himself by concentrating on details. In one corner of the tank, snuggled in a forest of fake kelp, was a life-sized plastic gingerbread cottage with bubbles coming out of the chimney. In the opposite corner, a plastic sculpture of a guy in an old-fashioned diving suit knelt beside a treasure chest, which popped open every few seconds, spewed bubbles, and closed again. Littered across the white sand floor were glass marbles the size of bowling balls and a strange assortment of weapons like tridents and spear guns. Outside the tank's display wall was an amphitheater with seating for several hundred.
What do you keep in here? Frank asked. Giant killer goldfish?
Forces raised his eyebrows.
Oh, that would be good. But no, Frank Chong, descendant of Poseidon, this tank is not for goldfish.
At descendant of Poseidon, Frank flinched. He stepped back, gripping his backpack like a mace he was prepared to swing. A sense of dread trickled down Percy's throat like cough syrup. Unfortunately, it was a feeling he was used to.
How do you know Frank's last name? He demanded. How do you know he's descended from Poseidon?
Well,
Forces shrugged, trying to look modest.
It was probably in the descriptions Gia provided. You know, for the bounty, Percy Jackson.
Percy uncapped his pen. Instantly, Riptide appeared in his hand.
Don't double-cross me, Forces. You promised me answers.
After the VIP treatment, yes, Forces agreed. I promise to tell you everything you need to know. The thing is, however, you don't really need to know anything.
His grotesque smile stretched wide.
You see, even if you made it to Rome,
which is quite unlikely, you'd never defeat my giant brothers without a god fighting at your side. And what god would help you?
So I have a better plan.
You're not leaving.
You're VIPs. Very important prisoners.
Percy lunged. Frank hurled his backpack at the sea god's head. Phorcys simply disappeared. The god's voice reverberated through the aquarium's sound system, echoing down the tunnel.
Yes, good. Fighting is good. You see, Mother never trusted me with big assignments, but she did agree that I could keep anything I caught. You two will make an excellent exhibit.
The only demigod spawn of Poseidon in captivity. Demigod terrors.
Yes, I like that. We already have sponsorship lined up with Bargain Mart. You can fight each other every day at 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. with an evening show at 7 p.m.
You're crazy, Frank yelled.
Don't sell yourself short, Phorcys said. You'll be our biggest draw.
Frank ran for the exit only to slam into a glass wall. Percy ran the other way and found it blocked as well. Their tunnel had become a bubble. He put his hand against the glass and realized it was softening, melting like ice. Soon the water would come crashing in.
We won't cooperate, Phorcys, he shouted.
Oh, I'm optimistic, the sea god's voice boomed. If you won't fight each other at first, no problem. I can send in fresh sea monsters every day. After you get used to the food here, you'll be properly sedated and we'll follow directions. Believe me, you'll come to love your new home.
Over Percy's head, the glass dome cracked and began to leak.
I'm the son of Poseidon, Percy tried to keep the fear out of his voice. You can't imprison me in water. This is where I'm strongest.
Phorcys' laugh seemed to come from all around them.
What a coincidence. It's also where I'm strongest. This tank is specially designed to contain demigods. Now have fun, you two. I'll see you at feeding time.
The glass dome shattered, and the water crashed in. Percy held his breath until he couldn't stand it. When he finally filled his lungs with water, it felt just like normal breathing. The water pressure didn't bother him. His clothes didn't even get wet. His underwater abilities were as good as ever. It's just a stupid phobia, he assured himself. I'm not going to drown. Then he remembered Frank, and he immediately felt a surge of panic and guilt. Percy had been so worried about himself that he'd forgotten his friend was only a distant descendant of Poseidon. Frank couldn't breathe underwater. But where was he? Percy turned in a full circle. Nothing. Then he glanced up. Hovering about him was a giant goldfish. Frank had turned, clothes, backpack and all, into a koi the size of a teenaged boy.
Dude.
Percy sent his thoughts through the water, the way he spoke with other sea creatures.
A goldfish?
Frank's voice came back to him.
I freaked. We were talking about goldfish, so it was on my mind. Sue me.
I'm having a telepathic conversation with a giant koi, Percy said. Great. Can you turn into something more useful?
Silence. Maybe Frank was concentrating, though it was impossible to tell since koi don't have many expressions.
Sorry,
Frank sounded embarrassed.
I'm stuck. That happens sometimes when I panic.
Fine, Percy gritted his teeth. Let's figure out how to escape.
Frank swam around the tank and reported no exits. The top was covered with celestial bronze mesh, like the curtains that roll down over closed storefronts at the mall. Percy tried to cut through with Riptide, but he couldn't make a dent. He tried to smash through the glass wall with his sword hilt. Again, no luck. Then he repeated his efforts with several of the weapons lying around the bottom of the tank and managed to break three tridents, a sword, and a spear gun. Finally, he tried to control the water. He wanted to expand and break the tank, or explode out the top. The water didn't obey. Maybe it was enchanted, or under the power of Phorcys. Percy concentrated until his ears popped, but the best he could do was blow the lid off the plastic treasure chest. Well, that's it, he thought dejectedly. I'll have to live in a plastic gingerbread house the rest of my life, fighting my giant goldfish friend and waiting for feeding time. Phorcys had promised they'd learn to love it. Percy thought about the dazed telkines, the nereids and hippocampi, all swimming in bored, lazy circles. The thought of ending up like that didn't help to lower his anxiety level. He wondered if Phorcys was right. Even if they managed to escape, how could they defeat the giants if the gods were all incapacitated? Bacchus might be able to help. He had killed the twin giants once before, but he would only join the fight if he got an impossible tribute. And the idea of giving Bacchus any kind of tribute made Percy want to gag himself with a monster donut.
"Look,"
Frank said. Outside the glass, Keto was leading Coach Hedge through the amphitheater, lecturing him on something while the coach nodded and admired the stadium seating.
"Coach!" Percy yelled.
Then he realized it was hopeless. The coach couldn't hear telepathic yelling. Frank bumped his head against the glass. Hedge didn't seem to notice. Keto walked him briskly across the amphitheater. She didn't even look through the glass, probably because she assumed the tank was still empty. She pointed to the far end of the room as if saying, "Come on, more gruesome sea monsters this way." Percy realized he had only a few seconds before the coach would be gone. He swam after them, but the water didn't help him move as it usually did. In fact, it seemed to be pushing him back. He dropped Riptide and used both arms. Coach Hedge and Keto were 5 feet from the exit. In desperation, Percy scooped up a giant marble and hurled it, underhanded like a bowling ball. It hit the glass with a thunk, not nearly loud enough to attract attention. Percy's heart sank. But Coach Hedge had the ears of a satyr. He glanced over his shoulder. When he saw Percy, his expression went through several changes in a matter of microseconds. Incomprehension, surprise, outrage, then a mask of calm. Before Keto could notice, Hedge pointed toward the top of the amphitheater. It looked like he might be screaming, "Gods of Olympus, what is that?" Keto turned. Coach Hedge promptly took off his fake foot and ninja kicked her in the back of the head with his goat hoof. Keto crumpled to the floor. Percy winced. His own recently whopped head throbbed in sympathy, but he had never been happier to have a chaperone who liked mixed martial arts cage matches. Hedge ran to the glass. He held up his palms like, "What are you doing in there, Jackson?" Percy pounded his fist on the glass and mouthed, "Break it." Hedge yelled a question that might have been, "Where's Frank?" Percy pointed at the giant koi. Frank waved his left dorsal fin. "Sup?" Behind Hedge, the sea goddess began to move. Percy pointed frantically. Hedge shook his leg like he was warming up his kicking hoof, but Percy waved his arms. No! They couldn't keep whopping Keto on the head forever. Since she was immortal, she wouldn't stay down, and it wouldn't get them out of this tank. It was only a matter of time before Phorcys came back to check on them. "On three," Percy mouthed, holding up 3 fingers and then gesturing at the glass. "All of us hit it at the same time." Percy had never been good at charades, but Hedge nodded like he understood. Hitting things was a language the satyr knew well. Percy hefted another giant marble.
"Frank, we'll need you too. Can you change form yet?"
"Maybe back to human."
"Human is fine, just hold your breath. If this works..."
Keto rose to her knees. No time to waste. Percy counted on his fingers. 1, 2, 3. Frank turned to human and shoved his shoulder against the glass. The coach did a Chuck Norris roundhouse kick with his hoof. Percy used all his strength to slam the marble into the wall. But he did more than that. He called on the water to obey him, and this time he refused to take no for an answer. He felt all the pent-up pressure inside the tank, and he put it to use. Water liked to be free. Given time, water could overcome any barrier, and it hated to be trapped, just like Percy. He thought about getting back to Annabeth. He thought about destroying this horrible prison for sea creatures. He thought about shoving Phorcys's microphone down his ugly throat. 50,000 gallons of water responded to his anger. The glass wall cracked. Fracture lines zigzagged from the point of impact, and suddenly the tank burst. Percy was sucked out in a torrent of water. He tumbled across the amphitheater floor with Frank, some large marbles, and a clump of plastic seaweed. Keto was just getting to her feet when the diver statue slammed into her like it wanted a hug. Coach Hedge spit salt water.
Pans, pipes, Jackson! What were you doing in there?
Forces,
Percy spluttered.
Trap! Run!
Alarms blared as they fled the exhibits. They ran past the Nereid's tank, then the Telkines. Percy wanted to free them, but how? They were drugged and sluggish, and they were sea creatures. They wouldn't survive unless he found a way to transport them to the ocean. Besides, if Forces caught them, Percy was pretty sure the sea god's power would overcome his, and Keto would be after them too, ready to feed them to her sea monsters.
I'll be back, Percy promised.
But if the creatures in the exhibits could hear him, they gave no sign. Over the sound system, Forces' voice boomed,
Percy Jackson!
Flash pots and sparklers exploded randomly. Donut-scented smoke filled the halls. Dramatic music, 5 or 6 different tracks, blared simultaneously from the speakers. Lights popped and caught fire as all the special effects in the building were triggered at once. Percy, Coach Hedge, and Frank stumbled out of the glass tunnel and found themselves back in the whale shark room. The mortal section of the aquarium was filled with screaming crowds. Families and day camp groups running in every direction while the staff raced around frantically, trying to assure everyone it was just a faulty alarm system. Percy knew better. He and his friends joined the mortals and ran for the exit. Chapter 17. Annabeth. Annabeth was trying to cheer up Hazel, regaling her with Percy's greatest seaweed brain moments, when Frank stumbled down the hall and burst into her cabin.
Where's Leo?
He gasped.
Take off! Take off!
Both girls shot to their feet.
Where's Percy?
Annabeth demanded.
And the goat!
Frank grabbed his knees, trying to breathe. His clothes were stiff and damp, like they'd been washed in pure starch.
On deck! They're fine! We're being followed!
Annabeth pushed past him and took the stairs 3 at a time, Hazel right behind her and Frank trailing, still gasping for air. Percy and Hedge lay on the deck looking exhausted. Hedge was missing his shoes. He grinned at the sky, muttering,
Awesome! Awesome!
Percy was covered with nicks and scratches like he'd jumped through a window. He didn't say anything, but he grasped Annabeth's hand weakly as if to say,
Be right with you as soon as the world stops spinning.
Leo, Piper, and Jason, who'd been eating in the mess hall, came rushing up the stairs.
What? What?
Leo cried, holding a half-eaten grilled cheese sandwich.
Can't a guy even take a lunch break? What's wrong?
Followed!
Frank yelled again.
Followed by what? Jason asked.
I don't know,
Frank panted.
Whales? Sea monsters? Maybe Kate and Porky?
Annabeth wanted to strangle the guy, but she wasn't sure her hands would fit around his thick neck.
That makes absolutely no sense.
Leo, you'd better get us out of here. Leo put his sandwich between his teeth, pirate style, and ran for the helm. Soon the Argo II was rising into the sky. Annabeth manned the aft crossbow. She saw no sign of pursuit by whales or otherwise. But Percy, Frank, and Hedge didn't start to recover until the Atlanta skyline was a hazy smudge in the distance.
Charleston,
Percy said, hobbling around the deck like an old man. He still sounded pretty shaken up.
Set course for Charleston.
Charleston? Jason said the name as if it brought back bad memories. What exactly did you find in Atlanta? Frank unzipped his backpack and started bringing out souvenirs.
Some beach preserves, a couple of t-shirts, a snow globe, and, these not really Chinese handcuffs.
Annabeth forced herself to stay calm. How about you start from the top? Of the story, not the backpack. They gathered on the quarter deck so Leo could hear the conversation as he navigated. Percy and Frank took turns relating what had happened at the Georgia Aquarium, with Coach Hedge interjecting from time to time.
That was awesome!
Or,
Then I kicked her in the head!
At least the coach seemed to have forgotten about Percy and Annabeth falling asleep in the stable the night before. But judging from Percy's story, Annabeth had worse problems to worry about than being grounded. When Percy explained about the captive sea creatures in the aquarium, she understood why he seemed so upset.
"That's terrible," she said. "We need to help them."
"We will," Percy promised. "In time. But I have to figure out how. I wish..."
He shook his head.
"Never mind. First we have to deal with this bounty on our heads."
Coach Hedge had lost interest in the conversation, probably because it was no longer about him, and wandered toward the bow of the ship, practicing his roundhouse kicks and complimenting himself on his technique. Annabeth gripped the hilt of her dagger. "A bounty on our heads, as if we didn't attract enough monsters already."
"Do we get wanted posters?" Leo asked. "And do they have our bounties, like, broken down on a price list?"
Hazel wrinkled her nose.
"What are you talking about?"
"Just curious how much I'm going for these days," Leo said. "I mean, I can understand not being as pricey as Percy or Jason, maybe. But am I worth, like, 2 francs or 3 francs?
"Hey!"
Frank complained. "Knock it off," Annabeth ordered. "At least we know our next step is to go to Charleston, to find this map." Piper leaned against the control panel. She'd done her braid with white feathers today, which looked good with her dark brown hair. Annabeth wondered how she found the time. Annabeth could barely remember to brush her hair.
"A map," Piper said.
"But a map to what?"
"The Mark of Athena."
Percy looked cautiously at Annabeth like he was afraid he'd overstepped. She must have been putting out a strong, "I don't want to talk about it" vibe.
"Whatever that is," he continued. "We know it leads to something important in Rome. Something that might heal the rift between the Romans and Greeks."
"The Giant's Bane," Hazel added.
Percy nodded.
"And in my dream, the twin giants said something about a statue."
Frank rolled his not-exactly-Chinese handcuffs between his fingers.
"According to Forces, we'd have to be insane to try to find it. But what is it?"
Everyone looked at Annabeth. Her scalp tingled as if the thoughts in her brain were agitating to get out. A statue. Athena. Greek and Roman. Her nightmares and her argument with her mom. She saw how the pieces were coming together, but she couldn't believe it was true. The answer was too big, too important, and much too scary. She noticed Jason studying her, as if he knew exactly what she was thinking and didn't like it any more than she did. Again, she couldn't help but wonder, why does this guy make me so nervous? Is he really on my side? Or maybe that was her mom talking.
I'm close to an answer, she said. I'll know more if we find this map. Jason, the way you reacted to the name Charleston, have you been there before?
Jason glanced uneasily at Piper, though Annabeth wasn't sure why.
Yeah, he admitted.
Reyna and I did a quest there about a year ago. We were salvaging Imperial gold weapons from the CSS Hunley.
"The what?"
Piper asked.
"Whoa," Leo said. "That's the first successful military submarine from the Civil War. I always wanted to see that."
"It was designed by Roman demigods," Jason said. "It held a secret stash of Imperial gold torpedoes until we rescued them and brought them back to Camp Jupiter."
Hazel crossed her arms. "So the Romans fought on the Confederate side? As a girl whose grandmother was a slave, can I just say, not cool?"
Jason put his hands in front of him, palms up. "I personally was not alive then, and it wasn't all Greeks on one side and all Romans on the other. But yes, not cool. Sometimes demigods make bad choices." He looked sheepishly at Hazel. "Like sometimes we're too suspicious. And we speak without thinking." Hazel stared at him. Slowly it seemed to dawn on her that he was apologizing. Jason elbowed Leo.
"Ow!" Leo yelped. "I mean, yeah. Bad choices. Like not trusting people's brothers who, you know, might need saving. Hypothetically speaking."
Hazel pursed her lips.
"Fine. Back to Charleston. Are you saying we should check that submarine again?"
Jason shrugged. "Well, I can think of 2 places in Charleston we might search. The museum, where they keep the Hunley,
That's one of them. It has a lot of relics from the Civil War. A map could be hidden in one of them. I know the layout. I could lead a team inside.
I'll go, Leo said. That sounds cool.
Jason nodded. He turned to Frank, who was trying to pull his fingers out of the Chinese handcuffs.
You should come too, Frank. We might need you.
Frank looked surprised.
Why? Not like I was much good at the aquarium.
You did fine, Percy assured him. It took all three of us to break that glass.
Besides, you're a child of Mars, Jason said. The ghosts of defeated causes are bound to serve you.
And the museum in Charleston has plenty of Confederate ghosts. We'll need you to keep them in line.
Frank gulped. Annabeth remembered Percy's comment about Frank turning into a giant goldfish, and she resisted the urge to smile. She would never be able to look at the big guy again without seeing him as a koi.
Okay, Frank relented. Sure.
He frowned at his fingers, trying to pull them out of the trap.
How do you...
Leo chuckled.
Man, you've never seen those before? There's a simple trick to getting out.
Frank tugged again with no luck. Even Hazel was trying not to laugh. Frank grimaced with concentration. Suddenly, he disappeared. On the deck where he'd been standing, a green iguana crouched next to an empty set of Chinese handcuffs.
Well done, Frank Zhang,
Leo said dryly, doing his impression of Chiron the centaur.
That is exactly how people beat Chinese handcuffs. They turn into iguanas.
Everybody busted out laughing. Frank turned back to human, picked up the handcuffs, and shoved them in his backpack. He managed an embarrassed smile.
Anyway, Frank said, clearly anxious to change the subject.
The museum is one place to search, but, Jason, you said there were two.
Jason's smile faded. Whatever he was thinking about, Annabeth could tell it wasn't pleasant.
Yeah, he said. The other place is called the Battery. It's a park right by the harbor. The last time I was there, with Raina, he glanced at Piper, then rushed on. We saw something in the park. A ghost or some sort of spirit, like a Southern Belle from the Civil War, glowing and floating along. We tried to approach it, but it disappeared whenever we got close. Then Raina had this feeling. She said she should try it alone, like maybe it would only talk to a girl. She went up to the spirit by herself, and sure enough, it spoke to her.
Everyone waited.
What did it say? Annabeth asked.
Raina wouldn't tell me, Jason admitted. But it must have been important. She seemed shaken up. Maybe she got a prophecy or some bad news.
Raina never acted the same around me after that.
Annabeth considered that. After their experience with the Eidolons, she didn't like the idea of approaching a ghost, especially one that changed people with bad news or prophecies. On the other hand, her mom was the goddess of knowledge, and knowledge was the most powerful weapon. Annabeth couldn't turn down a possible source of information.
A girl's adventure, then, Annabeth said. Piper and Hazel can come with me.
Both nodded, though Hazel looked nervous. No doubt her time in the underworld had given her enough ghost experiences for two lifetimes. Piper's eyes flashed defiantly, like anything Raina could do, she could do. Annabeth realized that if six of them went on these two quests, it would leave Percy alone on the ship with Coach Hedge, which was maybe not a situation a caring girlfriend should put him in. Nor was she eager to let Percy out of her sight again, not after they'd been apart for so many months. On the other hand, Percy looked so troubled by his experience with those imprisoned sea creatures, she thought maybe he could use a rest. She met his eyes, asking him a silent question. He nodded, as if to say, "Yeah, it'll be fine." So that's settled. Annabeth turned to Leo, who was studying his console, listening to Festus creak and click over the intercom. Leo, how long until we reach Charleston?
Good question, he muttered. Festus just detected a large group of eagles behind us. Long-range radar, still not in sight.
Piper leaned over the console.
Are you sure they're Roman?
Leo rolled his eyes.
No, Pipes. It could be a random group of giant eagles flying in perfect formation. Of course they're Roman. Suppose we could turn the ship around and fight.
Which would be a very bad idea, Jason said,
and remove any doubt that we're enemies of Rome.
Or I've got another idea, Leo said. If we went straight to Charleston, we could be there in a few hours, but the Eagles would overtake us, and things would get complicated. Instead, we could send out a decoy to trick the Eagles. We take the ship on a detour, go the long way to Charleston, and get there tomorrow morning.
Hazel started to protest, but Leo raised his hand.
I know. Nico's in trouble and we have to hurry.
It's June 27th, Hazel said. After today, 4 more days, then he dies.
I know, but this might throw the Romans off our trail. We still should have enough time to reach Rome.
Hazel scowled.
When you say, should have enough,
Leo shrugged.
How do you feel about barely enough?
Hazel put her face in her hands for a count of 3.
Sounds about typical for us.
Annabeth decided to take that as a green light. Okay, Leo, what kind of decoy are we talking about?
I'm so glad you asked.
He punched a few buttons on the console, rotated the turntable, and repeatedly pressed the A button on his Wii controller really, really fast. He called into the intercom.
Buford, report for duty, please.
Frank took a step back.
There's somebody else on the ship? Who is Buford?
A puff of steam shot from the stairwell, and Leo's automatic table climbed on deck. Annabeth hadn't seen much of Buford during the trip. He mostly stayed in the engine room. Leo insisted that Buford had a secret crush on the engine. He was a 3-legged table with a mahogany top. His bronze base had several drawers, spinning gears, and a set of steam vents. Buford was toting a bag like a mail sack tied to one of his legs. He clattered to the helm and made a sound like a train whistle.
This is Buford, Leo announced.
You name your furniture? Frank asked.
Leo snorted.
Man, you wish you had furniture this cool. Buford, are you ready for Operation End Table?
Buford spewed steam. He stepped to the railing. His mahogany top split into 4 pie slices, which elongated into wooden blades. The blades spun, and Buford took off.
A helicopter table, Percy muttered. Gotta admit, that's cool. What's in the bag? Dirty demigod laundry, Leo said. I hope you don't mind, Frank.
Frank choked.
What?
It'll throw the Eagles off our scent.
Those were my only extra pants,
Leo shrugged.
I asked Buford to get them laundered and folded while he's out. Hopefully, he will.
He rubbed his hands and grinned.
Well, I call that a good day's work. I'm going to calculate our detour route now. See you all at dinner.
Percy passed out early, which left Annabeth with nothing to do in the evening except stare at her computer. She'd brought Daedalus's laptop with her, of course. 2 years ago, she'd inherited the machine from the greatest inventor of all time, and it was loaded with invention ideas, schematics and diagrams, most of which Annabeth was still trying to figure out. After 2 years, a typical laptop would have been out of date, but Annabeth figured Daedalus's machine was still about 50 years ahead of its time. It could expand into a full-size laptop, shrink into a tablet computer, or fold into a wafer of metal smaller than a cell phone. It ran faster than any computer she'd ever had, could access satellites or Hephaestus TV broadcasts from Mount Olympus, and ran custom-made programs that could do just about anything except tie shoelaces. There might have been an app for that, too, but Annabeth hadn't found it yet. She sat on her bunk, using one of Daedalus's 3D rendering programs to study a model of the Parthenon in Athens. She'd always yearned to visit it, both because she loved architecture and because it was the most famous temple to her mother. Now she might get her wish, if they lived long enough to reach Greece. But the more she thought about the Mark of Athena and the old Roman legend Rhaena had mentioned, the more nervous she got. She didn't want to, but she recalled her argument with her mother. Even after so many weeks, the words still stung. Annabeth had been riding the subway back from the Upper East Side after visiting Percy's mom. During those long months when Percy was missing, Annabeth made the trip at least once a week, partly to give Sally Jackson and her husband Paul an update on the search,
and partly because Annabeth and Sally needed to lift each other's spirits and convince one another that Percy would be fine. The spring had been especially hard. By then, Annabeth had reason to hope Percy was alive, since Hera's plan seemed to involve sending him to the Roman side, but she couldn't be sure where he was. Jason had remembered his old camp's location more or less, but all the Greeks' magic, even that of the campers of Hecate's cabin, couldn't confirm that Percy was there, or anywhere. He seemed to have disappeared from the planet. Rachel, the Oracle, had tried to read the future, and while she couldn't see much, she'd been certain that Leo needed to finish the Argo II before they could contact the Romans. Nevertheless, Annabeth had spent every spare moment scouring all sources for any rumors of Percy. She had talked to nature spirits, read legends about Rome, dug for clues on Daedalus's notebook, and spent hundreds of golden drachmas on iris messages to every friendly spirit, demigod, or monster she'd ever met. All with no luck. That particular afternoon, coming back from Sally's, Annabeth had felt even more drained than usual. She and Sally had first cried and then attempted to pull themselves together, but their nerves were frayed. Finally, Annabeth took the Lexington Avenue subway down to Grand Central. There were other ways to get back to her high school dorm from the Upper East Side, but Annabeth liked going through Grand Central Terminal. The beautiful design and the vast open space reminded her of Mount Olympus. Grand buildings made her feel better. Maybe because being in a place so permanent made her feel more permanent. She had just passed Sweet on America, the candy shop where Percy's mom used to work, and was thinking about going inside to buy some blue candy for old time's sake, when she saw Athena studying the subway map on the wall.
Mother!
Annabeth couldn't believe it. She hadn't seen her mom in months, not since Zeus had closed the gates of Olympus and forbade all communication with demigods. Many times Annabeth had tried to call on her mom anyway, pleading for guidance, sending up burnt offerings with every meal at camp. She'd had no response. Now here was Athena, dressed in jeans and hiking boots and a red flannel shirt, her dark hair cascading over her shoulders. She held a backpack and a walking stick like she was prepared for a long journey.
"I must return home," Athena murmured, studying the map. "The way is complex. I wish Odysseus were here. He would understand."
"Mom," Annabeth said. "Athena." The goddess turned. She seemed to look right through Annabeth with no recognition.
"That was my name," the goddess said dreamily, "before they sacked my city, took my identity, made me this."
She looked at her clothes in disgust.
"I must return home."
Annabeth stepped back in shock. You're Minerva?"
"Don't call me that."
The goddess's gray eyes flared with anger.
"I used to carry a spear and a shield. I held victory in the palm of my hand. I was so much more than this."
"Mom," Annabeth's voice trembled.
"It's me, Annabeth. Your daughter." "My daughter," Athena repeated. "Yes. My children will avenge me. They must destroy the Romans. Horrible, dishonorable copycat Romans. Hera argued that we must keep the two camps apart. I said no. Let them fight. Let my children destroy the usurpers."
Annabeth's heartbeat thumped in her ears.
"You wanted that? But you're wise. You understand warfare better than any." "Once," the goddess said. "Replaced, sacked, looted like a trophy and carted off. Away from my beloved homeland. I lost so much. I swore I would never forgive. Neither would my children."
She focused more closely on Annabeth.
"You are my daughter?"
"Yes." The goddess fished something from the pocket of her shirt, an old-fashioned subway token, and pressed it into Annabeth's hand.
"Follow the mark of Athena," the goddess said. "Avenge me."
Annabeth had looked at the coin. As she watched, it changed from a New York subway token to an ancient silver drachma, the kind used by Athenians. It showed an owl, Athena's sacred animal, with an olive branch on one side and a Greek inscription on the other. The Mark of Athena. At the time, Annabeth had had no idea what it meant. She didn't understand why her mom was acting like this. Minerva or not, she shouldn't be so confused.
Mom, she tried to make her tone as reasonable as possible. Percy is missing. I need your help.
She had started to explain Hera's plan for bringing the camps together to battle Gia and the giants. But the goddess stamped her walking stick against the marble floor.
Never,
she said.
Anyone who helps Rome must perish. If you would join them, you are no child of mine. You have already failed me. Mother, I care nothing about this Percy. If he has gone over to the Romans, let him perish. Kill him. Kill all the Romans. Find the mark. Follow it to its source. Witness how Rome has disgraced me, and pledge your vengeance.
Athena isn't the goddess of revenge.
Annabeth's nails bit into her palms. The silver coin seemed to grow warmer in her hand.
Percy is everything to me.
And revenge is everything to me, the goddess snarled. Which of us is wiser?
Something is wrong with you. What's happened?
Rome happened, the goddess said bitterly. See what they have done, making a Roman of me. They wish me to be their goddess. Then let them taste their own evil. Kill them, child.
No.
Then you are nothing.
The goddess turned to the subway map. Her expression softened, becoming confused and unfocused.
If I could find the route, the way home, then perhaps. But no. Avenge me or leave me. You are no child of mine.
Annabeth's eyes stung. She thought of a thousand horrible things she wanted to say, but she couldn't. She had turned and fled. She tried to throw away the silver coin, but it simply reappeared in her pocket, the way Riptide did for Percy. Unfortunately, Annabeth's drachma had no magical powers. At least nothing useful. It only gave her nightmares, and no matter what she tried, she couldn't get rid of it. Now, sitting in her cabin aboard the Argo II, she could feel the coin growing warm in her pocket. She stared at the model of the Parthenon on her computer screen and thought about the argument with Athena. Phrases she'd heard over the last few days swirled in her head. A talented friend ready for her visitor. No one will retrieve that statue. Wisdom's daughter walks alone. She was afraid she finally understood what it all meant. She prayed to the gods that she was wrong. A knock on her door made her jump. She hoped it might be Percy, but instead, Frank Jong poked his head in.
Sorry, he said. Could I?
She was so startled to see him, it took her a moment to realize he wanted to come in.
Sure, she said. Yes.
He stepped inside, looking around the cabin. There wasn't much to see. On her desk sat a stack of books, a journal and pen, and a picture of her dad flying his Sopwith Camel biplane, grinning and giving the thumbs up. Annabeth liked that photo. It reminded her of the time she'd felt closest to him, when he'd strafed an army of monsters with celestial bronze machine guns just to protect her. Pretty much the best present a girl could hope for. Hanging from a hook on the wall was her New York Yankees cap, her most prized possession from her mom. Once, the cap had had the power to turn its wearer invisible. Since Annabeth's argument with Athena, the cap had lost its magic. Annabeth wasn't sure why, but she'd stubbornly brought it along on the quest. Every morning she would try it on, hoping it would work again. So far, it had only served as a reminder of her mother's wrath. Otherwise, her cabin was bare. She kept it clean and simple, which helped her to think. Percy didn't believe it because she always made excellent grades, but like most demigods, she was ADHD. When there were too many distractions in her personal space, she was never able to focus.
So, Frank, she ventured, what can I do for you?
Out of all the kids on the ship, Frank was the one she thought least likely to pay her a visit. She didn't feel any less confused when he blushed and pulled his Chinese handcuffs out of his pocket.
"I don't like being in the dark about this," he muttered. "Could you show me the trick? I didn't feel comfortable asking anyone else."
Annabeth processed his words with a slight delay. Wait, Frank was asking her for help? Then it dawned on her. Of course, Frank was embarrassed. Leo had been razzing him pretty hard. Nobody liked being a laughingstock. Frank's determined expression said he never wanted that to happen again. He wanted to understand the puzzle, without the iguana solution. Annabeth felt strangely honored. Frank trusted her not to make fun of him. Besides, she had a soft spot for anyone who was seeking knowledge, even about something as simple as Chinese handcuffs. She patted the bunk next to her. "Absolutely, sit down." Frank sat on the edge of the mattress, as if preparing for a quick escape. Annabeth took the Chinese handcuffs and held them next to her computer. She hit the key for an infrared scan. A few seconds later, a 3D model of the Chinese handcuffs appeared on the screen. She turned the laptop so that Frank could see.
"How did you do that?" he marveled.
"Cutting-edge ancient Greek technology," she said. "Okay, look. The structure is a cylindrical biaxial braid, so it has excellent resilience." She manipulated the image so it squeezed in and out like an accordion. "When you put your fingers inside, it loosens. But when you try to remove them, the circumference shrinks as the braid catches and tightens. There's no way you can pull free by struggling." Frank stared at her blankly.
"But what's the answer?"
"Well," she showed him some of her calculations, how the handcuffs could resist tearing under incredible stress, depending on the material used in the braid. "Pretty amazing for a woven structure, right? Doctors use it for traction, and electrical contractors..."
But the answer?"
Annabeth laughed. "You don't fight against the handcuffs. You push your fingers in, not out. That loosens the braid."
"Oh!"
Frank tried it. It worked.
"Thanks, but couldn't you have just shown me on the handcuffs without the 3D program and the calculations?"
Annabeth hesitated. Sometimes wisdom came from strange places, even from giant teenaged goldfish. "I guess you're right. That was silly. I learned something too." Frank tried the handcuffs again.
"It's easy when you know the solution."
"Many of the best traps are simple," Annabeth said. "You just have to think about it and hope your victim doesn't." Frank nodded. He seemed reluctant to leave. "You know," Annabeth said, "Leo doesn't intend to be mean. He's just got a big mouth. When people make him nervous, he uses humor as a defense." Frank frowned.
"Why would I make him nervous?"
"You're twice his size. You can turn into a dragon." "And Hazel likes you," Annabeth thought, though she didn't say that. Frank didn't look convinced.
"Leo can summon fire."
He twisted the handcuffs.
"Annabeth, sometime, maybe could you help me with another problem that's not so simple? I've got, I guess you'd call it an Achilles heel."
Annabeth felt like she'd just had a drink of Roman hot chocolate. She'd never really gotten the term warm and fuzzy, but Frank gave her that sensation. He was just a big teddy bear. She could see why Hazel liked him. "I'd be happy to," she said. "Does anyone else know about this Achilles heel?"
"Percy and Hazel," he said. "That's it. Percy, he's a really good guy. I would follow him anywhere. Thought you should know."
Annabeth patted his arm. "Percy has a knack for picking good friends. Like you. But Frank, you can trust anyone on this ship. Even Leo. We're all a team. We have to trust each other."
I suppose."
"So what's the weakness you're worried about?" The dinner bell sounded, and Frank jumped.
Maybe later," he said. "It's hard to talk about. But thanks, Annabeth."
He held up the Chinese handcuffs.
"Keep it simple."
Chapter 18. Annabeth. That night, Annabeth slept without nightmares, which just made her uneasy when she woke up, like the calm before a storm. Leo docked the ship at a pier in Charleston Harbor, right next to the seawall. Along the shore was a historical district with tall mansions, palm trees, and wrought iron fences. Antique cannons pointed at the water. By the time Annabeth came up on deck, Jason, Frank, and Leo had already left for the museum. According to Coach Hedge, they'd probably be back by sunset. Piper and Hazel were ready to go, but first Annabeth turned to Percy, who was leaning on the starboard rail, gazing over the bay. Annabeth took his hand. "What are you going to do while we're gone?"
"Jump into the harbor," he said casually,
like another kid might say, "I'm going to get a snack."
"I want to try to communicate with the local Nereids. Maybe they can give me some advice about how to free those captives in Atlanta. Besides, I think the sea might be good for me. Being in that aquarium made me feel unclean."
His hair was dark and tangled as usual, but Annabeth thought about the streak of gray he used to have on one side. When the two of them were 14, they'd taken turns, unwillingly, holding the weight of the sky. The strain left them both with some gray hair. Over the last year, while Percy had been missing, the gray streaks had finally disappeared from both of them, which made Annabeth sad and a little worried. She felt like she'd lost a symbolic bond with Percy. Annabeth kissed him. "Good luck, seaweed brain. Just come back to me, okay?"
"I will," he promised. "You do the same."
Annabeth tried to push down her growing unease. She turned to Piper and Hazel. "Okay, ladies, let's find the ghost of the battery." Afterward, Annabeth wished she'd jumped into the harbor with Percy. She even would have preferred a museum full of ghosts. Not that she minded hanging out with Hazel and Piper. At first, they had a pretty good time walking along the battery. According to the signs, the seaside park was called White Point Gardens. The ocean breeze swept away the muggy heat of the summer afternoon, and it was pleasantly cool under the shade of the palmetto trees. Lining the road were old Civil War cannons and bronze statues of historical figures, which made Annabeth shudder. She thought about the statues in New York City during the Titan War, which had come to life thanks to Daedalus's Command Sequence 23. She wondered how many other statues around the country were secretly automatons, waiting to be triggered. Charleston Harbor glittered in the sun. To the north and south, strips of land stretched out like arms enclosing the bay. And sitting in the mouth of the harbor, about a mile out, was an island with a stone fort. Annabeth had a vague memory of that fort being important in the Civil War, but she didn't spend much time thinking about it. Mostly she breathed in the sea air and thought about Percy. Gods forbid she ever had to break up with him. She'd never be able to visit the sea again without remembering her broken heart. She was relieved when they turned away from the seawall and explored the inland side of the gardens. The park wasn't crowded. Annabeth imagined that most of the locals had gone on summer vacation or were holed up at home taking a siesta. They strolled along South Battery Street, which was lined with four-story colonial mansions. The brick walls were blanketed with ivy. The facades had soaring white columns like Roman temples. The front gardens were bursting with rose bushes, honeysuckle, and flowering bougainvillea. It looked like Demeter had set the timer on all the plants to grow several decades ago, then forgotten to come back and check on them.
"Kind of reminds me of New Rome," Hazel said. "All the big mansions and the gardens, the columns and arches."
Annabeth nodded. She remembered reading how the American South had often compared itself to Rome back before the Civil War. In the old days, their society had been all about impressive architecture, honor, and codes of chivalry. And on the evil side, it had also been about slavery. Rome had slaves, some Southerners had argued, so why shouldn't we? Annabeth shivered. She loved the architecture here. The houses and the gardens were very beautiful, very Roman. But she wondered why beautiful things had to be wrapped up with evil history. Or was it the other way around? Maybe the evil history made it necessary to build beautiful things to mask the darker aspects. She shook her head. Percy would hate her getting so philosophical. If she tried to talk to him about stuff like that, his eyes glazed over. The other girls didn't say much. Piper kept looking around like she expected an ambush. She had said she'd seen this park in the blade of her knife, but she wouldn't elaborate. Annabeth guessed she was afraid to. After all, the last time Piper had tried to interpret a vision from her knife, Percy and Jason had almost killed each other in Kansas. Hazel also seemed preoccupied. Maybe she was taking in their surroundings, or maybe she was worrying about her brother. In less than 4 days, unless they found him and freed him, Nico would be dead. Annabeth felt that deadline weighing on her, too. She'd always had mixed feelings about Nico D'Angelo. She suspected that he'd had a crush on her ever since they rescued him and his big sister Bianca from that military academy in Maine. But Annabeth had never felt any attraction to Nico. He was too young and too moody. There was a darkness in him that made her uneasy. Still, she felt responsible for him. Back when they had met, neither of them had known about his half-sister Hazel. At the time, Bianca had been Nico's only living family. When she had died, Nico became a homeless orphan, drifting through the world alone. Annabeth could relate to that. She was so deep in thought, she might have kept walking around the park forever, but Piper grabbed her arm.
There.
She pointed across the harbor. 100 yards out, a shimmering white figure floated on the water. At first, Annabeth thought it might be a buoy or a small boat reflecting the sunlight, but it was definitely glowing, and it was moving more smoothly than a boat, making a straight line toward them. As it got closer, Annabeth could tell it was the figure of a woman.
"The ghost," she said.
"That's not a ghost," Hazel said. "No kind of spirit glows that brightly." Annabeth decided to take her word for it. She couldn't imagine being Hazel, dying at such a young age and coming back from the underworld, knowing more about the dead than the living. As if in a trance, Piper walked across the street toward the edge of the seawall, narrowly avoiding a horse-drawn carriage.
"Piper!"
Annabeth called.
"We'd better follow her," Hazel said.
By the time Annabeth and Hazel caught up to her, the ghostly apparition was only a few yards away. Piper glared at it like the sight offended her.
"It is her," she grumbled.
Annabeth squinted at the ghost, but it blazed too brightly to make out details. Then the apparition floated up the seawall and stopped in front of them. The glow faded. Annabeth gasped. The woman was breathtakingly beautiful and strangely familiar. Her face was hard to describe. Her features seemed to shift from one glamorous movie star to another. Her eyes sparkled playfully, sometimes green or blue or amber. Her hair changed from long straight blonde to dark chocolatey curls. Annabeth was instantly jealous. She'd always wished she had dark hair. She felt like nobody took her seriously as a blonde. She had to work twice as hard to get recognition as a strategist, an architect, a senior counselor, anything that had to do with brains. The woman was dressed like a Southern belle, just as Jason had described. Her gown had a low-cut bodice of pink silk and a 3-tiered hoop skirt with white scalloped lace. She wore tall white silk gloves and held a feathered pink and white fan to her chest. Everything about her seemed calculated to make Annabeth feel inadequate. The easy grace with which she wore her dress, the perfect yet understated makeup, the way she radiated feminine charm that no man could possibly resist. Annabeth realized that her jealousy was irrational. The woman was making her feel this way. She'd had this experience before. She recognized this woman even though her face changed by the second, becoming more and more beautiful. "Aphrodite," she said.
"Venus?"
Hazel asked in amazement.
"Mom,"
Piper said, with no enthusiasm.
"Girls,"
the goddess spread her arms like she wanted a group hug. The three demigods did not oblige. Hazel backed into a palmetto tree.
"I'm so glad you're here,"
Aphrodite said.
"War is coming. Bloodshed is inevitable. So there's really only one thing to do."
And that is?" Annabeth ventured.
"I have tea and chat, obviously. Come with me."
Aphrodite knew how to do tea. She led them to the central pavilion in the gardens, a white-pillared gazebo where a table was set with silverware, china cups, and of course a steaming pot of tea, the fragrance shifting as easily as Aphrodite's appearance. sometimes cinnamon or jasmine or mint. There were plates of scones, cookies and muffins, fresh butter and jam, all of which Annabeth figured were incredibly fattening. Unless, of course, you were the immortal goddess of love.